Well, there are bands that form the soundtrack to your youth, or in some case more like wallpaper from an era, an infamous appearance on Countdown, or in my case, my dad's very cool record collection. Dragon were one of those bands in the 70s and 80s more known for their hit singles on the charts to the general public rather than the genre-defying pub rock hard-living band that they were in and around Sydney. Lead singer Mark Hunter died in 1997 from throat cancer at the very young age of 44. He was a troubled, enigmatic, intelligent and difficult person. Traits I can only rattle off to you after reading the incredibly comprehensive Chasing the Dragon, a new biography from rock music journo Jeff Apter, formerly of Rolling Stone magazine. Very, very cool. Good morning to you, Jeff.
Tatiana, that was a fabulous intro, thank you.
Probably a bit long, really.
No, very good, very good.
That's okay.
It's been great talking to you. I've got to go now.
That's right. That's all we've got time for. Now, congratulations on the book, because it was a great read, if not a little disturbing in parts.
Oh, thank you very much. I mean, it was the same experience writing it, because of, you know, these incredible highs and lows in Mark's life and this lifestyle that he chose to pursue for a big part of his life. It was quite difficult in times to get it down on the page, and, you know, I quite often found myself having to just put the full stop and just walk away from the keyboard, because obviously his story ends tragically, and in a lot of ways you can see the direction his life was perhaps heading even when he was in his 20s,
you know,
he chose a certain lifestyle, he went a certain direction. The biggest tragedy, of course, of Mark's life is that when he got sick and died, he actually had his house in some kind of order. He'd married, had a couple of kids, was looking at opportunities outside of music, and was away from heroin. You know, he was really starting to live a more, well, normal life, if you like.
Absolutely.
And then he got sick, and, you know, throat cancer for a great singer. Well, he would never have been able to.
Yeah, that's the worst possible thing.
Mm.
Can I say, you had some pretty amazing access to the people in and around Mark's life, particularly his family, and it differed for the reader. Rather than that usual sort of obligatory paragraph or, you know, sometimes chapter where, you know, the parents, you know, say something, it was quite different to have the family's views peppered throughout, you know, the ups and downs of his life. How did that differ for you as an author, having that sort of access?
Well, obviously it made for a richer narrative, no doubt about it. And, you know, I'm eternally grateful to Mark's brother Todd and his mother Voy in particular for really opening up not just their archives, but opening up their hearts and really being generous with their observations about both good and bad about Mark. I think the passage of time makes things a little bit easier. I was working on this, some 12 years after Mark had died. I think if I'd attempted to write this book in, say, 2000, it would have been a much harder and probably less productive experience, because people felt obviously much closer and much more deeply affected by his death then as they do now. Not that he doesn't still touch their lives, but you can always speak with a bit more, I guess, levity about someone 10 years down the track. You know, you can see things a bit more clearly. And his mother, Voy, to her eternal credit, said to me, write an honest book.
Yeah.
You know, Mark was a flawed character, a beautiful, interesting, fascinating, challenging man, but a flawed character nonetheless. And, you know, she asked me to do that, which was unlocking, you know, it was like just unlocking the secret or the puzzle of Mark Hunter, if you like, the ability to be able to do that and do it with a clear conscience.
I think what was really interesting with his mother's perspective, Voy, in particular, was that although she gave you many different snippets and thoughts, she kept the letters that he wrote to her private.
Yes, yes. And you know, again, due respect to her for that. She was more than happy to go on the record and talk about, you know, some harrowing experiences, like confronting Mark as an adult, her and her husband Stuart, Mark's father, and looking down and seeing track marks, needle marks on Mark's arm, and saying, you know, what is that? Why are you doing that? And he said, there's such sadness in me, you'll never understand. You know, it's to recount that kind of encounter with their son is just, it was incredible. I was surprised. I kept looking over my shoulder expecting someone to say, no, you can't use that.
You can't actually use that. Yeah, that's it.
So, you know, but that what was the journey, and maybe this book is kind of a cautionary tale, if you like, about the excesses of that time.
Yeah, because I'd say that there isn't a lot of romance associated with some of the decisions that he made. I think and I think a lot of the time you certainly did paint an honest picture that he wasn't altogether a very nice man to a lot of people.
To a lot of people, but those whom he respected, he loved deeply. You know, the women that he had serious relationships, if you will, three of them, Annie Burton, who was a journalist, Kate Fitzpatrick, a well-known actress, and Wendy Heather, a fashion designer, the woman that he did eventually marry and spent the last 12 years of his life with. They weren't rock and roll dollies. They were
No, they were tough. Smart, weren't they?
They were. They were tough, serious, intelligent women. And that says a lot about Mark, that he didn't take that easy path with anything in his life. Mm. You know, unfortunately, he fell into a lifestyle in the 70s that stuck with him for a lot of his life, you know, probably up until the last few years of his life, trying to shake that monkey off his back. And it seemed as though Mark looked at life and said, well, there's the easy path and there's the interesting path. And he chose the interesting path. As James Raine said in the book, Mark took big bites.
Yes, that's probably a very nice way to put it, because people like Renee Gay and James Raine are incredibly complimentary and are almost a little protective, I guess, of Mark's legacy.
Yeah, as Renee said, she has a portrait of Mark in her house that she, you know, acknowledges every day of her life. You know, he was the most interesting, funny, challenging person she's ever met. And she said she's never met anyone like him. And so many people said that about Mark, that for all his flaws, he was this incredibly entertaining character. I spoke with Red Simons from the band Skyhooks, and now also on ABC Radio.
Yes.
And he said to me that when his band would travel up to Sydney, they go into a particular nightclub after a gig, and if Mark was at the bar, he said, great, it's going to be a big night.
Yeah, absolutely.
Never dull.
We get to some of those individual stories, and there's far too many to cover in one program, and certainly in a family time slot. But let's get back to those early years in New Zealand. They were very different for the Enigmatic frontman. He was overweight. He was bullied. He felt a little lost.
That's right. He was Fat Boy Hunter. You know, that was his nickname at school. He was 16 stone at the age of 16.
Wow.
I mean, God, at that rate, he would have been, what, 44 stone by 44? but he was cheeky. He was irreverent. He was very intelligent. He was raised in quite a stable middle-class environment in a rural township in the North Island of New Zealand. His father worked on the local council in a fairly high-placed administrative job. His mother was a teacher. They encouraged learning. They encouraged music at home. The band, the family band, used to play in the top paddock. it was a very civilized and quite, normal environment, if you like, that he was raised in. And to go from that, and what happened is the band, Mark accidentally joined the band. Todd was really the career musician, if you like. Todd was the one who always wanted to, Todd being his elder brother and the bass player of Dragon, of course, he always wanted to start a band, and he did that before Mark joined the band.
The long-suffering Todd, of course, who's referred to the rock
Saint
throughout.
Todd, some people refer to him as. You know, he was his brother's keeper for most of his life. And Todd had formed a band and was living on a commune in New Zealand when Mark, who'd been performing in his uncle's supper club band in Auckland, singing, you know, middle-of-the-road ballads and playing the drums. He just ambled in one day and the band was without a singer. Mark could sing. He didn't like rock and roll. He didn't like rock and roll at all. He was interested in the Carpenters and Sinatra, and the first record Mark ever bought was The Girl from Ipanema.
Which is, I think, I understand he got teased about. Rightly so, really.
No, that's
it. So I guess, you know, over the years, Dragon had many different incarnations. You know, Mark Hunter did a lot of solo stuff, but I think it was pretty clear, I think you could argue the same about In Excess, really, but I'm editorialising there, that the band wasn't Dragon without Mark Hunter.
Oh, absolutely right. Absolutely right. And it's, you know, the history is there, particularly in Australian music. When Shirley Strawn left Skyhooks, they were no longer Skyhooks. You know, when Peter Garrett left Midnight Oil, you know, they just had to hang up their hat. And I will editorialise, and I would say In Excess should have done the same when Michael Hutchins died, because, you know,
did you not do so well on the auditions to become the lead singer, Jeff?
Damn that. What was his name? J.D. Fortune.
Yes, but that might have been half the problem there, the name. Yeah.
I'm just not tall enough. But, you know, I think it's because Mark was the focal point and the vocal point, if you like, a key songwriter in the band. And really, when you saw them on stage, your eyes just, you know, zeroed in on this incredible presence. Dynamic.
Well, he was a commanding figure, wasn't he physically too?
Yeah, physically and as far as performance is concerned, in many other ways, you know, even to the point of being the guy who dished out a bit of rough justice on a crowd that might not be behaving so well. You know,
yeah.
Mark certainly didn't let back, and he was very interested in the interaction between audience and band. You know, there was no, there seemed to be no division between him and the audience sometimes, and quite often you'd find him in the audience.
Yes, sure.
So, yeah, once he left the first time around, you know, they floundered on. They made another record, and I think within weeks, the rest of the band realized it was a mistake. You know,
yeah.
Dragon without Mark Hunter was not Dragon at all. Although, you know, here we are in 2011 and Dragon are back on the road with Mark Williams and doing great. So, you know, perhaps that passage of time needed to elapse before they could consider Dragon version 3, which is the current one on the road.
Speaking of In Excess briefly, I noticed you referred to an episode of Countdown where Michael Hutchence was on pretty much the new kid on the block, being interviewed at the same time as Mark Hunter, and as you said, it was a study of contrast.
Oh, it certainly was. You know, it was at the time of Dragon's return, around the time of the hit Rain, which, you know, was a big...
Oh, that little song. Yeah.
And there was a really funny setup that Molly Meldrum was sitting between with Mark on one side, looking incredibly casual in a, you know, nice shirt and pants and a pair of shades.
Yeah.
And on his left was Michael Hutchence with his acne-scarred face, looking like a rabbit trapped in the headlights.
That's incredible, isn't it? Because we know him to be an enigmatic, you know, amazing, commanding person too now.
Yeah, of course. Well, I think he might have picked up a few things from Mark Hunter.
And, yeah.
During the interview, Molly, you know, said, Michael, you know, the new kid coming through with NXS, Mark, is, you know, you're returning now. Do you have any advice for a band on the rise? And, of course, he'd be the last person. And he looked at him and said, advice from me? And he thought it over for a moment and he said, stay clean.
Mm.
Now, it might have just been an aside or it might have been quite a poignant and pointed comment. I don't know. But,
yeah. Well, even if he'd worn it on his T-shirt or had it tattooed on his forehead, I'm not sure that anyone was listening to that.
No. But it was really interesting. It was certainly it was like a handing of the baton, if you like, from one Australian pin-up to another. It was
yeah.
a very interesting exchange, and I'd recommend anybody to YouTube it right now because it's a fascinating exchange, even though it's very accidental. You know, it really was a turning point, I think.
You're on 783 ABC Alice Springs Mornings. I'm Tatiana Clancy speaking with Jeff Apter, the author of Chasing the Dragon, Life and Death of Mark Hunter. Speaking of some of those pretty funny rock stories, let's face it, John Paul Young, who we understand to be quite a clean individual, straight individual, I believe they shared management at one point, and John Paul Young felt sorry for Dragon, so ended up going over there with a rather large fish for them to eat for the week.
Well, the setup is that a Dragon had just come over to Sydney, and there was five of them or six of them living in, you know, a squalid apartment in the inner city with cockroaches scuttling across the... It was very Dickensian, actually.
Yes.
And what had happened is their original guitarist, a guy called Ray Goodwin, had defected over to John Paul Young's All-Stars because, frankly, they were making a living. And... JPY felt very guilty about it, and at the same time, a guy called Wayne DeGrucci, who was managing Dragon, also went over to JPY's camp, and John didn't do it deliberately, it just happened, it was just circumstances, and he came over one day with this big paper, this parcel wrapped in paper, and Mark answered the door. He said, hello, John, what's that? He said,
love is in the air.
It's a fish. He said, I can't give you any money, but I can feed you for a while. And it turns out the band dined on this, you know, 20-pound fish for at least a week because they'd been living on lemons stolen from the tree next door. And playing gigs for cider and mints. And
it's very rock and roll. My goodness.
It was real hand-to-mouth stuff, you know. So there are a lot of these funny... Because, of course, it should be said, too, that the Australian... you know, rock and roll industry or the music industry was in its fledgling period then.
Yeah.
You know, and Dragon were trailblazers, to their credit. You know, they tapped into a new audience that were in the suburbs and away from the inner city. And that's how they really started to develop as a band and as, you know, the band that we know now and develop those songs that we still sing in the car, you know, some 30, 40 years down the line.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but
definitely.
They played 2-3 times a day, 6-7 nights a week, you know.
And I think what's amazing is, and I know they blew a lot of money and got a bit silly, but in the early days, I mean, I know it's the, you know, the 70s and 80s, but there wasn't a lot of money, really. I mean, the band was earning $1,000 a week, which really, when you think about how big they were at one point, it doesn't seem like a lot.
No. And of course, you have to also factor in the fact that Mark, in particular, had a lifestyle that, chewed through at least $1,000 a week.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Yeah, I mean, even at their peak, at their peak in before the first version of Dragon broke up in the late 70s, they were making $30,000 a night, which was seems like a lot of money. However, you know, overheads, production, all those.
And they had a lot of bills.
They had a lot of bills. Yeah. And, you know, Mark and other members of the band had millionaire tastes, you know, yeah. The heroin and champagne lifestyle, sucking up, you know, $200-$300 a day. You'd have to play a lot of gigs to maintain that.
You do. And look, you speak about lots of different Sydney landmarks that I confess I recognise because I grew up in the 80s in Sydney, in eastern Sydney. Lots of references too, and I can't believe that that he managed to get away from that, with Mark Hunter being quite comfortable at King's Cross, involved with a lot of the people that we now know in the infamous Underbelly series, Mr. Asia and all that sort of stuff. How did he escape, you know, criminal... any sort of criminal association?
Well, it's not. I must, you know, I have to illustrate that it's not clear, and it's not fair to say that Dragon were directly associated with Mr. Asia. It has been alleged that allegations have been made about that, and certainly when it was alluded to in the Underbelly series, Todd made a point of saying, "Hey, this is how." And what evolved was that their manager in New Zealand, when they first started out, had connections with a fellow called Terry Clark, who was part of the Mr. Asia syndicate. It was two or three steps removed from that. How Mark got away from that is fascinating. Their manager, seeing the damage that this lifestyle was causing the band in their first, you know, 76, 77, he moved them all to a share house up on the beautiful northern suburbs, northern beaches of Sydney. Mm. He figured, let's put them in a beautiful house, keep the fridge full of food, you know, let's get them away, put some distance between them and the inner city. Well, what happened is all the dealers moved into the house.
I mean, the traffic on the bridge is bad, but not that bad. Yeah.
It was like the monkeys from hell, you know.
Oh,
all
God.
These drug dealers went, great, you're living in this fantastic house. You're our key client. We'll just come and move in with you. So, but yet then, you know, 10 years later, Mark reinvented himself. You know, he became a family man, living in the, you know, a very comfortable estate and with small children and appearing on the social pages and being a public figure. You know, it was amazing how someone with such a reckless youth could then in later life be accepted by a certain level of society.
And be so, you know, interested in environmental causes and all that sort of stuff.
But he was, did blow a lot of money, it must be said, on an organisation called the Ozone Society. And this is well before we started talking about carbon tax.
Yeah, like they had some interesting ideas in the 80s about how to help plug the ozone hole, didn't they?
This one was fascinating. They had some pellets, I believe, they were going to float balloons over Mexico City and drop these pellets into the clouds over the city, and it was somehow going to treat the ozone. But yeah. Mark, being the entrepreneur that he was, he and his wife had designed a fashion label, a series of clothes, post-apocalyptic fashion line that they were going to sell to everybody after this treatment. So, you know, there was a certain business aspect to it as well. He wasn't Bono, let's put it that way.
No, that's fair call.
But he was interested in these things, you know, and he helped organize something, an event called Turn Back the Tide, which was one of the first green music fundraisers, if you like, held on Bondi Beach in the late 80s.
So, I remember the hoo-ha about that, actually.
Yeah, you know, in a lot of ways he was ahead of his time. And musically speaking, he did an album called Night and Day in the early 90s, which preceded Rod Stewart and the Great American Songbook by, you know, 10 or 15 years.
So, yeah, but Rod Stewart released it anyway, which we're, you know, well, I don't know how happy we are about that. Jeff, look, I could talk to you all day. Unfortunately, we're fast running out of time, and I really did want to also talk about the one night that Mark was shocked when he performed on a bill with Angry Anderson, and Angry Anderson decides to just get naked backstage and greet people.
It took a lot to shock Mark Hunter, but even Angry Anderson managed to do that. So
yeah, that's a little scary, really. but look, I did want to end with a very special song that people would normally associate with John Farnham. Did you want to introduce this for us?
Sure. There was a situation where John Farnham had approached Mark and Paul Hewson, one of the songwriters in Dragon, about writing a song for him. Todd and Todd's partner, Joanna Piggott, happened to be in the room at the same time, and when Mark didn't act on it, Todd and Joanna wrote Age of Reason. Dragon played it a bit. Mark recorded a vocal version of the song, but wasn't convinced it was a Dragon song, and of course it was at a time when Dragon desperately needed a hit. Mark Cuss, you know, shared the song and said, "No, it's for someone else." John Farnham picked it up and turned it into a huge hit.
Absolutely.
And revived his career on the basis of that. So it was the one that got away.
Yeah. Oh, look, Jeff, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time today.
Tatiana, absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeff Apter there, the author of Chasing the Dragon, The Life and Death of Mark Hunter. You're on 783 ABC Alice Springs. Here is that song that you normally associate with John Farnham, his Age of Reason, Dragon.
Options put before us.